You're sitting in as a wellness center, connected to a clinic, connected to a community health organization, and that's incredible.
A new clinic for Sutton. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, kids using technology to help adults.
Every year, usually, we have somebody that gets lost, and we hear of search and rescue having to go out and find them, and kids always worry about whether it's going to be one of their parents.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, and maintaining an open forum for public expressions, opinions, and concerns regarding subsistence, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, January 29, 2016. More information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A Superior Court judge has sided with Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation and ordered the city of Kodiak to immediately comply with the state's Public Records Act in a case of alleged excessive use of force by three Kodiak police officers. The order was handed down by Kodiak's Judge Steve W. Cole on Tuesday. KMXT Public Radio's parent corporation sued when the city denied the station's Freedom of Information Act request for details after an incident where three policemen handcuffed and pepper sprayed 28-year-old Nick Pletnikoff, who is severely autistic, as he was checking his family's mailbox on September 16th. Pletnikoff was not charged with any crime, but was left bloodied, bruised, and according to his mother, Judy, traumatized by his encounter with the KPD officers. KMXT sought more information about the incident, including the identities of the three officers. In his order, Judge Cole rejected the argument that a third-party investigation underway is an enforcement action and therefore exempts the city from complying with the Alaska Public Records Act. Judge Cole likewise rejected the city's assertion that it did not want to invade the privacy of those involved. Cole points out Pletnikoff's name is well known to the public and is part of the public record, and any witnesses interviewed did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy since they likely consented to the interviews. Cole didn't address whether the police officers' identities should be private, but said if the city had alleged that, it would not be a well-founded claim. In summary, Cole said in part, the city has not met its burden to show the disclosure request should be denied. Judge Cole has ordered the city of Kodiak to release to KMXT immediately, but no later than December 31st, the chest cam videos recorded by the three KPD officers during their response. Assistant Kodiak City Manager Mike Twangy said the city fully intends to comply with the court order. A sad story retells itself every winter in rural Alaska. People go out on the tundra and they don't come back. A group of Kasigluk students are working to change that story by creating affordable winter survival packs for their community. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the packs could save lives and win thousands of dollars in prizes for their school.
Every year, usually, we have somebody that gets lost, and we hear of search and rescue having to go out and find them, and kids always worry about whether it's going to be one of their parents.
That's Natalie Kelly. She's the Akyuk Memorial School teacher leading the project with a team of 6th through 8th graders.
They come in every day, and they get started right away, and they work for hours just trying to come up with the best things possible.
The project is part of a national competition to win about $120,000 worth of technology. The annual Samsung Solve for Tomorrow contest challenges students to solve local issues while building enthusiasm for STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math. Akyuk won the state level earlier this month and has until February to submit their final project. The winter packs hold three items: shelter, heating pads, and a survival manual. To make them affordable for every home, the students are using materials found around the village. They're testing different shelter designs made from tarp and tent fabrics, making sure the structures withstand high amounts of snow and wind. And they're creating reusable heating pads using a solution of household chemicals, mainly baking powder and vinegar.
It takes like 3 hours to cook down, and the kids very patiently kept at it.
The survival manuals add a cultural element to the project. The students are interviewing village elders about winter survival and compiling the information in a Yupik and English language guidebook. Callie says the classrooms involve elders and projects every year, and most students hold Yupik as a first language.
We want the community involved in the school, that there's this flow between what goes on in the community and what goes on in school, and that we all work together to support our students.
2 years ago, Callie's Akyuk team won state for creating a device that maps underwater currents beneath the ice to help in local search and rescue. The school won about $20,000 worth of technology for that project, which included multiple computers and tablets. Callie says for a small school of 85 students, the winnings provided a big boost.
The computers get used in 3 different classrooms for our reading program, and then the students are constantly using the tablet.
Akyuk will receive a similar package this year for winning state again. Seizing nationals could multiply that prize sixfold. But the main goal, Callie says, is bigger than winning.
I want my kids to see that they can do anything that they want, but still be a part of their local community.
Callie says her students are already talking about STEM careers. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
More than 100 people turned out last week for a ribbon cutting at a community health center in Sutton, a town on the Glen Highway, 60 miles northeast of Anchorage. The center will serve residents from Palmer to Eureka. And although the Indian Health Service contributed funding and the Chickaloon Native Village Council manages the center, it will be open to natives and non-natives alike. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The new facility is named Atna Waitana Naidinia Den, or Atna Chickaloon People Gathering Place. Chickaloon Traditional Chief and Chair of the Tribal Council, Gary Harrison, says the center is the result of unity, determination, and many years of effort. He says the idea was launched by elders, including some who didn't live to see their dream of a local health facility realized, including local clan leader and matriarch Katie Wade.
I want to especially remember my Aunt Katie. She was the inspiration a long time ago on this. And I also want to recognize my Aunt Helen. And I want to recognize that both their daughters are here to see this today.
Throughout the presentations, speakers mentioned the help and guidance of aunts, uncles, grandparents, brothers, cousins, parents, and sisters. Gloria O'Neill is president and CEO of Cook Inlet Tribal Council, or CITC. She says Chickaloon tribal leaders have long worked to foster cooperation and partnerships. She says Gary Harrison, for instance, helped CITC organize in its early days. She says the building reflects that approach.
When I think about what this represents, this healing place, in this in beautiful location, it's truly the embodiment of who we are as a tribal people, that we need one another to not only survive but to thrive, that we're interdependent, and that we truly are more than just friends, we're family.
Lisa Wade is a Chickaloon Village Traditional Council member and the tribe's Director of Health, Education, and Social Services. She says the building has open spaces indoors and out for community gatherings. It also includes several features that local residents asked for, such as a gym, locker room, and showers, as well as several exam rooms, a telepharmacy, radiology services, a room for minor procedures, and more.
We have a larger clinic downstairs. We have a wellness center. I think it's about 1,500 square feet. And then upstairs we have the health social services offices. So all of our elders programs, our behavioral health aides, and our advocates that we have working for us will be located upstairs.
Anchorage-based health services provider South Central Foundation was a partner with the tribe in the planning, design, and construction of the center. SCF family physician and medical director Dr. Doug Eby says the building was also designed with both disease prevention and medical care in mind.
What you're sitting in is a wellness center connected to a clinic, connected to a community health organization, and that's incredible. And the message this attitude brings to all of us about bringing all of that together, mind, body, spirit, wellness, illness, medical, and community health and well-being. It's just a fabulous, fabulous model.
The center will serve both natives and non-natives and provide a broader array of services than the existing tribal clinic. It's four times the size of that clinic. The health center will begin seeing customers in January. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau man who keeps kids guessing with his annual holiday decorations.
I add Santas every year. That's always new. The kids come and count the Santas.
How many Santas?
I can't tell you. Yeah, the kids got to count them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A third person has been charged with murder in the shooting deaths Monday of two Anchorage men following a failed drug transaction. Anchorage police say 23-year-old Solomon Brown Tavita is charged with two counts of second-degree murder and one of drug misconduct in the deaths of 22-year-old Jeremiah Teluga and 33-year-old Robin Porter. Tavita was arrested Wednesday night at a home in the Spinard neighborhood. Also charged are 26-year-old Linda Chattel and Porter's wife, 31-year-old Megan Pugh. Police say Chattel drove Teluga and Tavita to buy drugs from Porter and Pugh. Teluga entered the seller's car, a fight broke out, and gunshots were fired, mortally wounding Teluga and Porter. Police say Chattel and Tavita briefly pursued Porter and Pugh as they drove to a hospital. University of Alaska Fairbanks women swimmers and basketball players are barred from participating in postseason NCAA events this year. UAF officials say the NCAA Infraction Appeals Committee denied the school's challenge to the bans. KUAC's Robert Hannon has the story.
The bans are part of a wider array of penalties that resulted when UAF reported some 40 of its Nanook athletes violated eligibility requirements from 2008 to 2012. The violations occurred in 9 out of 10 UAF athletic programs. UAF Athletics Director Gary Gray says the school accepted most of the penalties, but appealed the bans on postseason competition for women swimmers and basketball players.
We totally felt that this was an inappropriate penalty, and that's the argument we made, and we lost.
In its rejection of UAF's appeal, the NCAA said it was the breadth and depth of violations that swayed them to keep the bans in place. Gray says there were admittedly a lot of violations over an extended period of time.
There's no question the system had problems. The good news is it's outstanding now. It's corrected. It has been for over 3 years.
This season, the bans only impact women's basketball and swimming. Other teams affected served their postseason bans last year. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Skiing on roads in the Haynesboro is illegal, and those gliding down local thoroughfares can be dinged with a fine. One ski enthusiast is spearheading a campaign in hopes of changing that minor offense. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has the story.
Currently, Eric Stevens has collected nearly 140 signatures on a petition to do away with that violation. If fined, a rogue road skier would have to pay $25 for a first offense and $5 for each subsequent offense. Stephen says the catalyst for the petition is simply that he and many others he knows would like the option of skiing to work or to the grocery store.
People are always just like, oh, it's so stupid. This is the most ridiculous thing. We need to change this. And we've been talking about this for years, and I finally decided, like, it's time someone should take it on as a cause.
Stevens brought the case to the Minor Offenses Ordinance Ad Hoc Committee last month. The committee members had mixed reactions. Here's Stevens addressing the committee with response from committee chair Bill Thomas and member Ron Jackson.
I mean, I've got this petition here. I don't know if I can deliver this to you, if I can read it to you.
We know what you want, but that, again, this is not ours. We can eliminate the fine, but we can't do anything about the...
Okay, well, yeah.
Point of order. He's got 3 minutes here. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Well, he said it, but okay.
Despite being dismissed by a few of the committee members, Stephen says he's optimistic that the committee and ultimately the assembly will see that skiing on roads offers a healthy transportation alternative.
I don't think I did a very good job of getting the message across. I think there's still some work to be done with the committee to make sure that everybody understands what we're asking, so we're going to keep trying.
Dan Egolf has lived in Haines since 1980 and says the issue has been coming up for a couple of decades. He says that rewriting the law so that people can ski on the roads but would have to abide by traffic laws is a good solution.
It was enforced historically 20 years ago, and from talking to Eric, there have been people been told to get off their skis and to walk back, and it seems like another one of these laws that needs to be looked at.
The Haines Minor Offenses Committee meets next on December 17th at 5:30 p.m., Among other topics, the group will discuss who the enforcers should be when it comes to doling out citations. In Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
With Alaska recidivism rates hovering above 60%, helping prisoners transition back to society successfully is as important as ever. Some prisoners enter a halfway house and receive substance abuse treatment, housing, help with employment, and education. In Juneau, Gastineau Human Services provides these treatment options. Independent radio producer Ilisanga Millengrock lived at Gastineau Human Services, attended substance abuse treatment on his way out of prison, and brings us this profile.
Back in 2012, I'd been in for 6 years for assault, and that wasn't the first time I'd been to prison. I'd been through treatment and transition programs before, but none of them worked like Juneau's Halfway House and its associated services like alcohol treatment. I wanted to put a finger on what worked this time, and here's the story. To start, I went back to the Halfway House and spoke to a client.
I hit rock bottom, lost everything I had.
Meet Craig Porter.
It took being sober and sitting in a jail cell to realize truly how much I had hurt people that I cared about and that loved me, and how much I had hurt myself, and just took a real moral look at myself, and I kind of disgusted myself.
We're sitting in the halfway house, and he's sitting in the same chair I was 2 years ago. On a day-to-day basis, there's an average of 80 clients, and I see other women and men coming and going, and I wonder if they'll make it on the outside.
Drug addiction is what brought me to jail to begin with, and heard about going to the halfway house, GHS, unsentenced. So I figured I'd try that, and anything could be better than sitting behind bars.
Unsentenced is prison speak for postponing a court appearance. And during that time, you have an opportunity and possibility to avoid a harsh sentence by entering something like the halfway house.
I started talking with the staff and learning more about Juneau Therapeutic Court, and the more I learned about it and what its main purpose was, I decided it would be a good idea to give it a try.
The Juneau Therapeutic Court is among the services attached to the halfway house and is run by people like GHS counselor Michael Rowcroft.
I consider my approach to counseling as client-centered.
Rowcroft worked with me back when I was here. I appreciated the way he helped me get through the denial and admitting that I had a problem with alcohol. We then made a plan.
The next stage is action. So you take action, you take the plan, and you put it and implement it and start working on the developing the tools of recovery, we call them.
For me, the tools of recovery included talking about my problem and being honest and thinking more positive. And they worked. Slowly, like Craig's experience now, I was able to get out of the halfway house and do more in the community. That's part of the plan, says GHS's Director of Client Services, Michelle Federico.
We work with folks on looking at some of their other reentry needs, looking at changing thoughts and behaviors. We offer a structured phase system that people earn privileges over time so that they, with good behavior, they are allowed to do more in the community.
Craig's about half my age, and I hope he makes the most of his tools of recovery so he can enjoy the rest of his life.
Before I got to jail and got help from the staff at GHS and through Juno Therapeutic Court, I really wanted to quit. But I didn't know what to do or where to go.
And he has a little advice of his own.
You need to ask for help if you want it, because it does not come and knock on your door. And there's no one that's going to tell you you have to quit and you're going to quit. You have to really want it. You know, go talk to someone if you want the help. Don't wait for it to come to you.
If you do need help, GHS offers a wide variety of services open to the public as well. As for Craig, I wish him continued success, and I'll check with him to see how things are going. In Juneau, I'm Ilasonga Milligrock.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Each December, there is a spike in impaired driving-related accidents. Consider the real costs of driving impaired. It could result in the loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
364 days a year, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, is the U.S.-Canadian military unit that monitors North American airspace for enemy threats. But one day each year, NORAD turns its watchful eye onto one very popular air traveler. That well-known traveler is flying above South America right now. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
Part of the NORAD mission is to keep skies safe. Safe for pilots, safe for passengers, and safe for sleighs pulled by flying reindeer. Watching Santa Claus each Christmas Eve is an annual mission NORAD takes very seriously. They've been at it for 60 years. Here's Lieutenant Joe Naraki.
We will monitor and track Santa to make sure that he is safe and secure.
Well, Joe, tell me, how do you guys do it? How do you track Santa?
Well, obviously, we in the military and at NORAD have a multitude of radars and satellites at our disposal.
Using those tools, they monitor Santa's voyage around the world.
Basically, he starts at the international dateline and travels west.
Naraki says Alaska is Santa's second-to-last stop, with only Hawaii being farther west. Tracking Santa is a mission NORAD came into by accident.
There was an ad that was placed in a Sears catalog at Christmas time, and it said, hey kids, if you want to talk to Santa, call this number. Well, the number on the advertisement was misprinted, and it actually rang to the ops center at, it was called CONAD at the time.
A colonel named Harry Shoup answered the line in 1955, and when he realized that kids were trying to get their bearings on Santa Claus, he knew that he was pretty well equipped to answer this question, being in the air defense business and all. So he played along, and it's been a NORAD tradition ever since. Kids desperate to know where the jolly old fellow is can call the NORAD Santa Tracker hotline at 1-877-HI-SANTA. And a small army of volunteers in Colorado Springs is on standby to fill kids in on Santa's progress. Even the First Lady takes calls from her family's vacation home in Hawaii. NORAD's not the only one in the Santa tracking business. The tech company Google has its own Santa Tracker, 11 years young. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
Juneau resident Jeff Campbell bought two truckloads of Christmas lights and decorations at a garage sale more than 20 years ago. He decorates his house in a big way. People joke that you can see his home from space. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
16, 17, 18, 19,
20. On a drizzly Monday night, 8-year-old Ferguson Wheeler counts the number of Santa Clauses at Jeff Campbell's house in a neighborhood near the federal building known as the Flats.
I add Santas every year. That's always new. The kids come and count the Santas.
How many Santas?
I can't tell you. Yeah, the kids got to count them.
Besides Santas, the busy lights display includes reindeer, candy canes, nativity scenes, nutcrackers, drummer boys, Disney and Winnie the Pooh characters, and thousands of lights. There's not much room to walk around the yard. Campbell has even wired some outdoor speakers to play Christmas music. Among the prefabricated decorations, Campbell creates his own, like
Snoopy on his house because of the new Peanuts movie, whatever the newest kid movie out, the Christmas movie. I try and do a character from that.
There's more than 600 lights on a plywood board in the shape of Snoopy. So many lights, you can feel the heat coming off it. Campbell has been covering his house and yard with lights and decorations since the early 1990s, and each year the display grows.
98% of it's from a garage sale, unless I get something on a blowout sale at a store.
He starts setting up for Christmas right after he takes the Halloween lights and decorations down. He tends to put things in the same spot every year for simplicity's sake.
Some of these guys are marked where they go, so I don't have to think about it, and it gets out a lot faster.
He points to a written message on the back of a Santa.
Under the ash tree. So I have that. I know where he goes.
This season, Campbell debuted the lights on December 4th, flipping 8 switches. Daily, the lights go on after work and off around 9 or 10 p.m. He'll turn them off for good in early January. His electricity bill has been doing better since LED lights became part of his collection.
But it used to triple from what we normally had, and then now it's doing better. It's a little over double.
The cost of holiday joy, though, is priceless. Campbell's house is known around town. Little kids in childcare walk by during the day. Cars are constantly slowing down. Children walk in his yard to pose for photos next to the decorations, something Campbell has no problem with.
A neighbor one time did hijack a Santa. He took pictures around town with him, up on the tram and the glacier, and had pictures of him sent to us.
Decorations are also occasionally given. Campbell points to a Goofy next to some bushes on the edge of the property.
He was put here. Someone left him.
Campbell wants to find a better spot for Goofy.
Either I'll move him out further or I'll find a place in the yard for him. I got one already, so I have to keep him separated. I don't want him fighting.
If you haven't stopped by Jeff Campbell's house on West 11th Street in the Flats, make sure you do. And count the Santas. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Jacqueline Estes and Monica Goki in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Jillian Rogers in Haines, Illisongut, Mill and Rock, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. From all of us at Alaska Public Media and APRN, happy holidays and Merry Christmas, Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska Pacific University delivers an affordable education and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.